Hello?
Hello?
Yes, this is Joy.
Hi, Joy. This is Carolyn. How are you?
I'm awesome. And yourself?
I'm good, thanks.
Awesome. I think we're on for the money story.
Money mastery, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Well, hey, everybody.
Okay.
This is Dave. How are you guys doing?
Doing great, Dave.
Hi.
Great.
Thank you.
What kind of things would you like to talk about before we start our material today? Any lingering questions or clarifications from our first seminar or anything from what you thought about?
Well, I certainly spent a lot of time giving it thought, that's for sure.
Okay,
I hadn't really thought about it.
If you left the seminar puzzled and confused, then my work for the day was done. think about that. That's what we do in coaching, is we perturbate a closed system. Someone has a way of doing things. They've rewired their brain. They have a default mode, but it may not be working, or at least working optimally. So we ask questions that perturbate the system to develop, ultimately, self-reflection, self-empathy, and
mm-hmm.
beginning to question things. So I think
right.
that's the very best thing that that you can do, is to begin to reflect on the story you're writing. That's going to put you in the very best position to help your clients, if you're those of you who are professional coaches, to work with developing their stories. So thank you for that feedback. That's good. Say who this was.
It was Carolyn.
Welcome. Hey, great. Thanks. Okay, super. Other
thoughts? Mary, I'm here too.
I didn't quite hear you. Say it again, please.
This is Mary. I'm here too. Hello.
Welcome. Any thoughts or any questions?
Not yet.
Okay. All right. Here's a quiz to start with. That it may surprise you, since it has nothing to do with money, but I have three questions. Jot down your first and immediate response to each of the questions. What did you do in the last week that you want to do more of? First thing, because that's the emotional response, that's your midbrain most true self response, the first response. Two, what did you do in the last week that you want to do less of? And three, first answer again, how do you use your strengths today? How do you apply your strengths today? First thing. Think about that, and think about, as you reflect on it, maybe after our class or into the week, what relationship that may have to your money story, even though it's not about money at all. So I want to ask you, while we're still on discussion mode, because this is a kind of preface to what we're going to talk about, we're going to begin to talk about the roadmap system for a new money story, for understanding and revising a money story. How many of you know how to program a computer? Algorithms, codes, pattern sequences? Anyone?
Very long ago.
Okay. I'm going to teach you how to reprogram a brain. Now, we don't know the algorithm formula, but we see the clues, and we know about behavior and emotional and attachment patterns. And we know that a lot of the methods to change, to facilitate change, are really contrary to the way the mind and brain work. So this is what we're going to do, to look at that response that's automatic, the 90 to 95% of unconscious responses that are based on algorithms for attachment, behavior, emotional problems, and emotional just responses, all kinds of behavior. And that includes the unconscious biases and the beliefs and the belief system we have, including about money. So we're going to deconstruct that and look at how to understand a money story using the roadmap system. going to send you a link to an ebook that is a compilation of 32 roadmap case studies that were done by the coaches I've trained as wellness coaches, as Money Story mentors, and there's an annotation of each of the five sections, life stories, wellness stories, money, career, relationship. I think you'll find it useful and see after you've had an introduction to it today, and we'll continue that in the next two seminars, how powerful having a system is in order to really understand and change something. Remember we talked earlier, if you want to change a habit, focus on the system, not the goal. So this is a way to focus on the system. So anything else before we move to lecture mode? Any other comments or thoughts or questions at this point? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and I'll reserve some time at the end for discussion. So if you have anything you'd like to talk about or ask about, jot it down. Okay, we've discussed your money story and the concept of writing a new money story. Now we're going to look more closely at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change step by step. We're going to look at the essential steps of change to create a new money story that's successful and fulfilling. We're going to look at the seven steps. Roadmap is the acronym for those seven steps to understand and create a new and powerful money story. So just an overview, and this is in your outline. The overview of the roadmap. Recognize authorship of your shadow money story. Every choice of earning, spending, saving, investing, giving. Own your second step, own your money story. Accountability is a prerequisite to change. Recognize the different contents of states like beliefs, doubts, anxiety, negative self-talk. Mindfulness and awareness of your story is necessary before change. We're going to go through these in a stepwise way, but this is just an overview, a kind of précis of coming attractions. Okay. Assess the plot and storylines, behaviors, messages, language. What's the dominant theme of your money story? Are there limiting beliefs? Fourth step, decide what to change, what to keep, let go, change, and enhance. Map the next best action and changes, goals, success strategies. Author new changes, and then finally, program new experiences and identity. This is such an important step because it incorporates the change as part of an identity, and there's a transformation, not just of behavior, but of your identity. And that's what makes change permanent. And that's what we do in working with clients, is to help them integrate what they're doing differently into a new working model of themselves, of how and who they are, which is the core essence of their identity. So let's look at this in more detail. Step one, recognize authorship of your money story. And remember this premise. Every moment, we actively construct what we think, feel, and experience. Each step is a choice. Insight, understanding, even coming to the end of the past of an old story are important, but they're not enough. You have to create a new or at least revised story. So, how can you tell your money story to yourself to know what to keep, what to change? There are four principles in recognizing authorship. First principle, our experiences are always consistent with our assumptions. In other words, our beliefs write the software of our behavior. And we see what we believe and we're always right because we write the story. Here's an example. It's a true story. Out of Oxford, a number of years ago, two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. The two anthropologists lived for a year, did not compare, did not have any conversation, and then emerged to compare notes. And they and their teams expected remarkable similarities, yet there were striking differences. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony. He achieved a real unity and comfort with the ape. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his ape colony. He remained careful and vigilant, was always right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved a comfort and harmony. The anthropologists and their teams could not understand the discrepant results. They puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful, vigilant outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed, he never used it, the apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew that if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun had a commitment. He knew from the beginning that he would either make it or not on his own. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, and our story tells us then. A belief is the mind's command to the brain. With the same belief, you'll continue the same results. If you change your belief, you can have different results. Second principle. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. Our beliefs become our reality. And some things you have to believe in order to see. Our possibilities are always a manifestation of what we allow ourselves to consider. Think about this in terms of your money story. A story can define possibility. And you guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was scientifically impossible. Then in 1954, Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Within the following 18 months, a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. And now, just in the United States, it's broken about 20 times every year. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. There's an interesting story that I've learned more recently about Bannister, who trained when he was going to medical school. Over his lunch hour, he was consistently told by all the people who should know about how scientifically impossible it was, and that if anyone ran under a mile, ran under 4 minutes, that it would kill them. So when he crossed the finish line after having broken the record, he actually passed out. And then when someone revived him, he said, "Am I dead?" So, our beliefs within us, our own internal map of reality, determine our perception of what surrounds us, including what and how we select, register, and process. So, we have to bring our beliefs about money, finances, and wealth into conscious focus to assess how well they work in present time. The choices we make as parents, for example, are models that our children will emulate. They look, experience, take unconscious notes, and those notes get passed on. Same with our clients. We know that so many beliefs and behavioral patterns are downloaded during the first years of life without even conscious recognition. Third principle. A new story can only occur by living in the present moment. Social scientists discovered that when you measure someone's present intention, you affect their future behavior. For example, when people were asked what they intend to do, they are more likely to act according to how they answer. When you ask people the day before an election if they intend to vote, it increases the probability of their going to vote by 25%. A study of 40,000 people asked, "Do you intend to buy a new car?" The question increased purchase rates in the next 3 months by 35%. Other behaviors with increased frequency: asking if people intend to eat certain foods, to eat more healthily, to exercise, to regularly refund retirement plans. Principle 4. Our minds seek closure and infer causality, whether or not it's accurate. There was a series of studies that Dan Gilbert at Harvard did where he showed in volunteers words appearing on a computer screen for a few milliseconds. This was subliminal programming. It was such a short time, they were unaware that the words were shown. They could not pick them out or guess from a multiple choice, yet they were influenced by them. For example, when the word hostile was flashed, volunteers would judge others more negatively for a period of time after that. When the word elderly was flashed, the volunteers would walk a bit more slowly. When the word stupid was flashed, they would perform slightly less well on tests. Yet, when these volunteers were asked why they judged or walked or scored the way they did, they didn't say, "I don't know," but instead they quickly considered what they were aware of and come up with some reason. For example, the volunteers who walked more slowly first did not believe that, but then they were shown proof by showing them the video and told that they were given subliminal programming. They didn't believe the subliminal programming that could influence them in that way. They attributed various things to a cause and effect relationship. "Well, I was a little bit tired when I did the test," or, "I've been traveling the last few days and I haven't slept well," or, "I'm jet lagged." Each was unaware of the fact that they were falsely attributing cause and effect. Now, this is a natural inclination that we have in our minds and brains to bring closure, for our brains to end any dissonance by imposing certainty, and for our minds to create a complete story by a causal explanation that infers both closure and a sense of effectiveness. Complete trumps accurate. It takes work to maintain an open question in the brain. So we tend to create closure. This is why we rationalize or justify or do any number of other mental gymnastics that bring closure without ownership or growth, kind of like a finish without an ending. And this is also how confidence and clarity create an experience of trust in the listener. One thing I won't go into now because of time, but I want to refer you to a blog that I did that's archived. And the blog is simply titled The Zeigarnik Effect, Zeigarnik. It's an example from a story of someone who is meaningful to me of how this was originally studied by the father of social psychology, Kurt Lewin, who is also my psychoanalytic grandfather. You'll have to read to find out more about that. And when you read it, you'll find out why I framed it in that way. And remember the various ways that we get people to pay attention and to hold interest. Think about the presentations you've done or the ones you've been to where you really had consistent attention. There was a question that was asked, and the answer wasn't given immediately, and that kept your mind open and in an exploratory mode. In fact, Stephen King has summarized this in the most succinct way that I know of what is it that holds people's attention the best. It's when you began with a question, when you began with a mystery. He put it simply, the thing that an author simply needs to do is to have the reader always asking, what's next? So, step two, own your story. Own your money story. I'd suggest to review the assumptions and motivations that construct storylines. It's an exercise, page 2.5 of the workbook. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our beliefs determine what we see and then how we process it. It's our software package. Adding more information to the million bits of data that we possess daily, like a new diet, a health club membership, is not going to have an impact unless you change the software. So, here's an equation I think that you might find helpful. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Some examples of empowering beliefs. I can make the money I need. I'll find a way to love my work. Limiting beliefs also influence reality and behavior and create their own closure. I can't find time to exercise. I don't have enough experience. I don't make enough to save anything. So notice that these examples are a variety of responses, behaviors, reactions, even complex patterns. First, you have to recognize each experience as a choice instead of just the way things are. So here's a fundamental precept of step two, own your story. Whatever you experience, you either create or accept. So let's apply that by talking about two aspects now about your story, point of reference and active versus passive positions. Point of reference is a basic component of story writing. People who don't own their stories have a premise of an external point of reference. This theme can include passivity or resignation. A theme may be of helplessness. They transfer responsibility to someone or something outside themselves. They react to situations they're in. And here are some typical characteristics of those with an external point of reference, a reactive mode. They may feel as if they have little or no control over things. Well, life is just happening. Well, there's nothing I can do. They're vulnerable to the responses of others. Their language can even absolve them of responsibility. She makes me so mad. They may focus on responding rather than creating. Well, I have to do this. They may see themselves as unchanging. Well, that's just the way I am. They may believe they have only a way to change by changing the outside source or person. Or when they experience a symptom in their bodies, they may medicate it away. That's like seeing a warning light on the dash of your car and turning it off rather than pursuing the problem. Now, contrast that with those with an internal point of reference who see their authority as their own. Their premise is acceptance of responsibility. Their theme is effectiveness. They know that the story is not there until they write it. They know that at least since adulthood, they absolutely write every aspect of their story. So here are some characteristics. They recognize accountability for their lives. They're proactive. They plan. They look around the corner. When experiencing an unpleasant result, they examine the chain of events that generated that result. Maybe then look for alternatives. When they see a result that doesn't work, they decide not to continue. They decide what to change and then initiate that change. And they realize that the menu of choices is also created. You can choose, and you can choose how you choose. Now, let's consider another aspect of story writing. To recognize active versus passive positions. Here are some examples of a passive language that reflects the person's orientation to how they see themselves. Well, I ran out of time, so I couldn't work out. I can't seem to put money into savings. This seems to keep happening. Now, every one of those to me is a coachable moment to freeze frame that and look at it and look at the construction of the language as if it's just happening, as if the speaker is the subject of that rather than the author. You have to eliminate all the outs. Remember the anthropologist. The idea of a gun was enough to change everything. There's also a blog that is first, because I just posted it last week. You may want to sign up for the blog so you don't have to keep going to it. But an example of this is the blog that contains the subtitle, A Requiem for Russell Stover Chocolate-Covered Cherries. Now, I heard this in person from a prominent neuroscientist, Dr. Bruce Lipton. 95% of people have no genetic basis for their unhappiness, their fears, or what they're taking medication for. These passive positions disown the feelings, thoughts, or action as an active creation, as if the feeling you create seems to make you its victim. And then the story can become an identity. I'm a risk taker. I'm a bargain hunter. Also, a coachable moment, as we were talking moments ago. And it can take on a life of its own. Someone creates credit card debt and then personifies it to become a victim of its demand and threat, a victim of its influence to decrease a credit score, and even take on a life of its own, as if the company that agreed to loan you money on your word to pay it back suddenly has a malevolent intent. So step three now. Once recognizing and owning your money story, step three is assess your money story, plot, and storylines. As we've discussed before, a belief or a fact is an anatomical reality in your brain, a physical part of a neuronal network and pathway system. A teacher can't simply present an explanation and remove an existing neural network in a student's brain. You can't just list three reasons that an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. And that's why suggesting something to do for the client, trying to fix it, not only activates the error detection mechanism that this is not right or not what I expected, but there's pushback because you're trying to overwrite an anatomical reality by a simple fact of a better way to do it according to you. But change can occur. It's a process, not an event. So this step to assess your money story, plot, and storylines includes examining beliefs and assumptions to see if any are limiting and to consider other beliefs. What's another way to look at this? How might this thought be limiting me? Who has a different perspective on this that I could explore? Are there questions I'm afraid to ask? And remember, at some level, you know they are. And you know what they are. Remember, denial is a powerful engagement, just like a secret is. What do I really want, and what do I need to let go of? So, let's look at one aspect of this, distinguishing and addressing needs and ideals. Ideals and needs are at the core of identity, part of the foundation of a sense of self. They're both essential to know in order to align goals and strategies with fundamental needs and ideals, to be sure all of you is going the same direction. Ideals are internal standards of excellence. They're a model of value, an internal guide to purpose. In fact, living up to a personal, attainable ideal is the only place that I know that self-esteem comes from. The opposite, failure to live up to an internal ideal, results in a feeling of shame. Not of guilt, but of shame. Needs are essential requirements, a necessity for mind, body, or spirit. Unmet, frustrated needs can create discomfort. A need may be most obvious when it's not met. So, it may be especially important to distinguish wants from needs. You can get sick if you don't have enough of a need of mind, body, and spirit. You can get sick if you have too much of a want. And you can never get enough of what you don't need. That's the definition, in one sense, of an addiction, a promise that's never kept. So, let's talk about comfort zones. Remember we did the thumb exercise last seminar and just introduced the idea of comfort zones, and I want to elaborate a little bit more about it now. A comfort zone is a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process, but once established, resists change. A comfort zone is analogous, in a way, to your home thermostat. If your temperature increases or decreases, even a little, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute. We each have a comfort zone, for example, with our weight, with how much money we make. We return to the familiar even when we don't like it, even when it's not comfortable. This is simply a zone of the familiar, the default mode that we've repeated enough and have ingrained so that it becomes automatic. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices. You go to your favorite restaurant, you look at the menu, but you know what you're going to order because you order the same thing every time. How difficult it is to start a new exercise program. How difficult it is to commit to a savings program. A comfort zone can be the repeated role you play in a relationship or procrastination of lifestyle changes you know you need to make, such as, again, establishing a structured savings plan. A comfort zone may manifest in certain patterns or storylines or simply recurring characters in your life, the same face on dozens of different people. Working under pressure, waiting until the last minute, creating a crisis can be a comfort zone. For example, someone can be accustomed to procrastination and then have that surge of cortisol and adrenaline and excitement and being able to finish just in time. So they've created a habituation to that neurochemical flourish at the ending and then the relief of finishing just in the nick of time. Here's another example of a comfort zone in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound winnings to return to their previous situation. In the United States, just over 80% of lottery winners of $3 million and above file bankruptcy within the first 5 years. Their money changed, but their mindsets didn't. So much money moved them from their comfort zone, and they ended up returning to it. Here's another example. A simple Irish woman lived an ordinary life in a small village for over 4.5 decades. Then, suddenly, she was vaulted onto the world stage with Britain's Got Talent. One of the initial results for Susan Boyle is that she became overwhelmed and had to be hospitalized the day after the final competition. She, like lottery winners, wasn't motivated to sabotage herself, but simply experienced overload way beyond her ability to handle it in her comfort zone. In the beginning, departure from a comfort zone feels by definition uncomfortable, a rupture of continuity, a routine is broken. Sometimes letting go of a comfort zone occurs only when the pain is too great to remain in it. The choices we make tend to be from our comfort zone, but a comfort zone can trade passion for predictability, creativity for continuity, and the new for the familiar. And remember, a habit is not a self-definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated, our collection of repetitions. So, to break out of your comfort zone, your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. When someone gets more successful, they may feel vaguely uncomfortable, just different. Their results go outside their self-image, and it cues an internal thermostat to signal a return to the comfort zone. That unconscious thermostat is just that, unconscious, until it becomes conscious. Whenever something's unconscious and you make it conscious, it's no longer unconscious. That no longer works then. Then you can reprogram your mind and brain. And your brain has a mind of its own. Now, another aspect of the assessment of your money story. Understand conflicted and contradictory storylines. When you feel with one part of the brain and plan with another, you need a map, as we've discussed before. A paradigm, called also a mindset, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. With the right map, planning and strategy can make a significant difference. Now, we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We often are not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. Recently, some very interesting research has shown that the brain works like a Google map. We have a stimulus and we boot up a particular map to deal with a certain scenario that's related. And we have another cue or trigger, we boot up another map. So this is one of the reasons to be sure that we have a cohesive story that aligns all of these maps, these paradigms and stories, to make an integrated whole. Now, a dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. Now, let's look at this in terms of practical application and coaching. If you read the anxiety or uncertainty of a new experience in an old paradigm, such as anxiety equals danger ahead, better head for cover, or uncertainty means wrong decision, or anxiety means my intuition is telling me this is not right, it makes sense to stop. So this is where we need to reflect on a current paradigm that reframes the anxiety as the excitement. Remember, the brain reads anxiety and excitement in the same way. The meaning is determined by the framework that we impose. So we help a client look at an experience of anxiety or uncertainty or trepidation in doing something new in a framework that indicates excitement, that simply validates progress. It's a signpost of moving ahead in new territory. Another concept, we need to be afraid of the right thing. We tend to fear, as we know from cognitive psychology and behavioral economics, what is most recently remembered and what is more emotionally salient, the recency effect. We fear what we can't control. It's more dangerous to be behind the wheel of a car, but in airplane seat 18C, especially after we've heard about an airplane crash recently, we feel no control. It's an availability bias, a prediction based on greater emotional charge. Another example, smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their lives by less than 1 day. People fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attacks. So here's a question. Are you afraid enough of not having abundance in later years to plan and save sufficiently for it now? What if you live to be 100? If you've planned to live to 70 or 80 or haven't planned, it's time to go back to the drawing board. There are a lot of studies that show money is not related to happiness and many other things that it promises or represents. But here is one relationship, as you think about saving for the future, the one thing money influences for all classes, for all groups of people: choice. Now, one of the unique qualities we have as human beings is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. This means that we can learn from our experiences and from other experiences as well. This is why we can create a new story. We are not our old story. We created that old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. We create them. We can think about those things and reflect on them. We can examine our paradigms to see if they serve us well. So in a very simple way, we can assess our money stories in four basic ways. Monitor our choices, question our ideas, probe our reasoning, ask clearly and honestly, does it work? Now, here's a quote for the guys, because guys inevitably are the ones who will not stop and ask for directions when we're hopelessly lost. I know these things. C.S. Lewis said, "We all want progress, but progress means getting nearer to the place where you want to be. And if you've taken a wrong turn, then to go forward does not get you any nearer. If you're on the wrong road, progress means doing an about turn and walking back to the right road. And in that case, the man who turns back soonest is the most progressive man." Notice even Lewis said man twice. We are always reaching our goals. It's just helpful to know consciously what they are, because we're reaching our goals whether they're conscious or unconscious. So if your personal or professional life is not as gratifying as you would like, if you believe you haven't attained your objectives, look more closely. It's helpful to know consciously and specifically what those goals are. You might be undermining your success by being too vague in your objectives. Do you fear specifically, yet dream vaguely? An example, if you want to change your body, begin with changing your body image. Visualize the specific image you want to achieve, your ideal body image, your true body self. Not a false body self of overweight or out of shape, then create an informed plan to get there. Your body is the projection of your mind's software. So is your savings account. So is your bank account. Listen to your language in regard to your goals. If you say you'll try to reach a goal, you may be protecting yourself from anticipated failure. Trying immediately says there's not a full commitment, but a potential diversion to other alternatives against failure. Now, think about it. You know the words of someone not committed. I'll try. I should. I ought to. I know I need to. These build in a takeaway, a detraction, by not being totally committed, by creating an out, like the anthropologist with the gun. When someone says, well, I'm going to try to quit drinking, you know they're going to keep drinking. Here are the words of someone committed, and this is what you want to get to as a close of your coaching session with each client when they make their commitments. I will. Now, let's look for just a moment as we wrap up the first three steps of the roadmap. Creating a new belief. How we tell our stories of the past will shape our future. Some stories get told so much or so often, they achieve a status of becoming a personal myth. If I were just loved enough, if I just had enough money. When you're ready to write a new belief, focus on it frequently and return to it regularly. The new belief has to replace the old belief. Create a vision of yourself getting the results from the new belief. Now, here's a brief story to illustrate how the value we attribute to something, in other words, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something. Nathan Handworker put in a new food stand in 1916 in Coney Island. Handworker's hot dogs were pure beef, made from his wife's recipe, every bit as delicious as his competitors, but he priced his at 5 cents, and other hot dogs at the time were 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People wondered if his hot dogs were inferior and attributed poor quality ingredients to his products. His sales were worse when he offered free root beer and free pickles because the free products furthered the perception that the value must be really substandard. Then, Handworker came up with a new ploy. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes, and he raised his prices. His hot dogs started selling. People assume two things. If physicians were eating his food, the early benefit of endorsement, and that it cost more than his competitors, it had to be good. So Nathan's famous hot dogs began selling well, became a national phenomenon, still exists today. Creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take some period of time. It can occur quickly, or it can take years to complete. It's a process. And the process of changing a belief is just that, a process, not an event. But it can be planned and strategically and systematically approached. That's what the roadmap is about, the steps to understand and deconstruct a story and reconstruct a new one, to create new operating algorithms. And it takes however long it takes. It's your process. It's not anyone else's. Don't compare your inside to someone else's outside. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison. Don't compare your journey, your timetable, to your progress with anyone else's. It's uniquely yours, your story. Your story, your life, is not a competition or a comparison. And this is something you may want to consider as part of self-reflection or even share with a client when they're wondering. You can always know the difference between avoidance and dosing and timing. And that's an important distinction. Avoidance you need to address, dosing and timing you need to respect. So in changing your belief and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind and your brain. The choices you make generate the moment-by-moment life you live. The programming of your internal map of reality, your software, is an ongoing process of revision. At any moment in time, Neural networks are influenced by three factors: genes, experiences, and focused attention. Not one of those alone, but all three in combination. Regardless of someone's unique brain architecture and individual complexity, these three factors intersect at any moment, at any nanosecond. DNA downloads its information from expression of its code. We now know that it goes in the other direction too. Our experiences, our beliefs even, can turn genes on or turn them off to determine the major extent of the expression of DNA-related information. That's how powerful a new story can be. And one final thought. Whatever remains unconscious will be attributed to fate. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. If I can get you to manage the background noise, I'm interested in thought, questions, and your reflections on what you're hearing.
Hey, hi, this is Victor. I was thinking about something when you said it too, because I was wondering how much, I get the, you know, the mind links, it distorts, it deletes, it generalizes, the mind does all these things, you know, and it's our image and everything. But I was thinking to myself about, like, cognitive biases, logical fallacies, all these things we create, and just how much it contributes to the stuff we do about, you know, getting in debt, you know, about not thinking about these things, about, I guess, how we get ourselves in trouble, you know, the heuristics and all that.
Yes.
Versus, like, the story we tell ourselves, because, I don't even know if it matters, but is that why we tell ourselves certain stories, why we see things as valid versus invalid, because of these fallacies and heuristics?
Well, it is something that we do automatically, because unconscious biases and financial fallacies may not be in awareness. So, I mean, there are a number. I detailed the secret language of money, like 25 different financial fallacies and unconscious biases that we have about money and how to look at remedying each. But the remedy is about awareness and self-reflection, because it gets to choice architecture. Whatever we decide, it may be on autopilot and it may be automatic, but it still is an active choice. And once we're aware of that, we can determine exactly what we do. It's not a given. It's not fate. It's something we actively do. We have an unconscious bias in some aspect of money. And once we're aware of that, then, you know, I mentioned some of the biases, just some common examples in last seminar. And once we're aware of them, we can address that in a way that we can make a choice in this moment in time, not that default mode that may be based on an earlier software program that's outdated or an unconscious belief that and bias that no longer works. So this is about an awareness and addressing that in a systematic way. So I think the simple answer to your question is yes, and this is a system, one of the systems to do this. It's the best system I know, and I continue to look at and refine and work on that all the time. But it is a way to do that, and that's why I'll be interested in your responses and your experiences as you reflect on it, as you put it to use, see how useful it is to you. This is how I've refined it over a period of time, is getting feedback from others. I mentioned also, and I'm reminding myself at this time, I'll send you that link to the ebook on the roadmap case study.
Okay. If I may ask one more thing, I'm glad you said system, because, I mean, it seems like it's really important, but I was thinking about this, how we are on autopilot. We do have our habits. In order to do the whole breaking the habit pattern interrupt, you have to be aware, that awareness muscle, but that's just it. It's a muscle. So how, I mean, isn't that, doesn't that mean that mindfulness, meditation, concentration exercises, or maybe just the right support systems in place will really, it's the only way I can think of that can help you break those patterns. Otherwise, it's never going to change, right?
Exactly. There are two ways you can do that. The use of the tools and the exercises that I have in the workbook is a way to do that self-reflection. One way especially is to work with a mentor coach. And in that way, and that's, as I mentioned at the very beginning, that's a story busting to look at together collaboratively the aspects of a story and to understand how to do that in a systematic way, and then also in a systematic way how to create changes that last. So that's also an elaborate, yes, for
okay.
So very important.
Thanks.
In another way, is there another question? I want to put this in a different language, but I don't want to cover any questions or thoughts. Other questions, other input?
This is Carolyn. I'm sorry.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit louder or get closer to your microphone?
Oh, okay. Hold on. Sorry. Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Way better. Right. Thank you.
It's a great deal of reflective analysis, self-reflective analysis. At least that for me, that's what it's been. And because I hadn't really considered my relationship with money, meaning I hadn't given it a lot of thought. You know, I follow the one credit card is all you need rule of thumb, and you know, don't create more debt than than you can generate in revenues, that sort of thing. So I've always sort of had that approach, but I have to tell you, since that last class, I'm incredibly mindful of any transaction, you know, almost to the point where, at least this is just my take on it, where, you know, I'm having the conversation in the process, in the middle of the transaction of, do you need this? You know, is this something that you need to buy? And it's really, there's a lot of angst for me. I'm just going to be very straight about that.
May I coach you for a moment?
Please do. Yes.
Whenever you hear a client move from first person, as you just did, we speak usually in first person. We say I or we, meaning that we're at the center of our experience. We're taking ownership. If suddenly a client moves to say you in referring to themselves, they've distanced themselves just a bit from that. It's like moving from the playing field to the observer's platform. There's something about what they just experienced that is uncomfortable or anxiety-provoking or just not quite fitting, so they make the observation from the perspective of saying you, as if they're a little bit away from the center of the heart of their experience. Look at interviews on television when somebody's being asked some tough questions. When they switch to you, they immediately got uncomfortable, and they're looking at it as an observer. So something about when you ask that question about, do you really need it? The do I really need it was a question that was a little bit uncomfortable. And that's exactly the purpose of this. That's why, like, when I do a more formal training of coaches and license and specialty certification in this area, why the exercises and the work tools that they may use on themselves and they can use with clients can facilitate all of this, because this is not easy, and this is how looking at and reflecting in a systematic way of having exercises, of having work tools, of going through it just as you're describing, and having a way to ask questions, knowing the questions to ask, I think, are really important, and you just exemplified that by what you're doing and how you're doing it. Now, did what I say about the you and I make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, I hadn't, until you said it, I hadn't considered that that's exactly what it was. Yeah.
Watch a few politician interviews, and you'll have it down easy. Okay. Well,
Well, I appreciate that. Thanks for the input. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. If there are questions or aspects that we didn't get to, jot it down. We'll pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much for all of your energy and input and the positive comments in the email. Don't hesitate to drop me an email or save your question for next time. We'll pick up right here next Monday. Thanks very, very much. Bye now.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.